Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Welcome back to Small Caps. Now, today, I've got a really great interview with you for you guys. I'm talking to John Borshoff. Now, many of you will know John. He was the former CEO of the Paladin Group. He's had over 40 years' experience in the uranium industry, and he is currently the CEO and Managing Director of Deep Yellow. What I'm going to ask John to speak to us today about is understanding the uranium industry as a whole, because I think that at the moment it's really it's not something people are talking about. Obviously, post Fukushima in 2011, everybody's gone away from it. People have forgotten that it's probably uranium is one of the cleanest energies that we can use. John and I have just spoken briefly off camera, and he feels that it's uranium's time to shine. So we're going to do a deep dive into the sector itself. Then we're going to talk about John's current company, Deep Yellow. And I hope we're going to educate everybody out there a little bit more on the exciting opportunities in the uranium sector. John, welcome to Small Caps. Great to see you over there in Perth.
Thank you, Kerry. Great to be here. And I hope I can match your expectation this morning.
John, I've known you for a few years, and some people call you the father of the uranium industry. You have had many, many years in the sector. And as many people will know, it's had its ups, it's had its downs. And right now, I just think that people aren't talking about uranium. They don't actually understand the sector. And I'd really like to get your views on uranium as a sector. Why you think that it's not being looked at all at the moment, and what you feel could be the future, especially from, I guess, an investing point of view, because I think pre-Fukushima, there was something like over 600 companies exploring for uranium. And today, I think it's something like, is it 60?
Yes, that's right. Worldwide. And that includes 10 government or multinational groups like BHP, who are byproduct producers of the product. So it's been decimated, and which in itself is the opportunity that is there for the investor as we go forward, which I'll explain later.
So let's talk about the background too. I mean, everybody remembers Chernobyl. People remember Fukushima. It scares people, and then they all say, well, we just don't want to talk about it. Let's go back to, I think you've got a slide, haven't you, of from, I think, 1945 up to 2020. And I think that paints a really interesting picture. So let's bring that slide up, because what that will show the viewer is some of the challenges that the industry has had.
Yeah. I'll do that. Can you see it?
Not yet.
Not yet. That's...
This is what we get, lazy right now. You know that that John and I are so good at technology. So while John's bringing that up, but if you can't bring it up, it doesn't matter. I think there should be a share screen button down the bottom of the screen.
Yeah. I'll just...
Of the screen.
Here we go. So the share screen.
Yep.
There we are. No, I can't. I can't get our share. Here we go.
There we go. See, ladies and gentlemen, look at that. And then,
And here it comes. So we're right, okay. Are we?
Yeah, that's perfect. Because and the reason I wanted you to bring this one up, John, because it does show some key elements in there. If you could talk to this one, I think it's really interesting.
So this really, once you see, there's a huge lot of information here, and it shows you the sort of dynamics of what uranium is. On the on the big picture, what you see here is over since 45, the cumulative, or not cumulative, but the annual production of uranium, as is reflected by that graph that you see before you. And there are basically three, and it's the big thing is it's only a short 75-year history, which with some key events that have had a profound effect on the evolution of nuclear and the opportunities that then that created. So if somebody was going to take away and say, well, look, what do I want? What's my takeaway on this? It's just to realize that 75-year history, the first cycle, 45 to about 71, was essentially military inspired. There was an exploration boom there, very sort of Cold War-ish, prospectors and major companies, and uranium was in high shortage. And then once the arsenals were filled, if you like, by 71, from zero production in 1945, we had about 2 billion pounds produced in that period, basically for weaponry. In the 65 period, or some electrification started to happen. Nuclear reactors were coming in, and then the oil shock came in, and that's about the period I came into the industry, about 1974, and right continuous throughout the period till today. But that was an amazing period of discovery. Every company was involved, and it was just a joy to work in. And a lot of the deposits that are in existence today were found in that period. The next
John,
event.
John, just before you go on, what attracted you in the first instance to the uranium sector? Because I believe you're a geologist by background, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And so I was in nickel before 2-3 years, and then this uranium business started, and the whole energy thing, and I felt that nuclear was going to be part of the future. So I made my change then and started off in Australia, and then joined multinationals, Canadian oil company. Then my big experience was with a West German group, which was a national group, and in fact started all the new deposits and major discoveries in Canada. And but where that period, great discovery, the global uranium map was completely redefined. So from a complete scarcity in the military early 50s to quite an abundance in as Australia was opened up, Africa and Canada, and of course at that time the US was a great producer, and in the post 75 period it became less and less as its deposits were being mined out. But the real effect here that affects us today is the depressed outlook that occurred, where there was just a massive, massive contraction of the industry, and people just exited the sector. And geologists and engineers and all of these people, but mainly in the geological sector, that were in their sort of 40-50 year experience, where they would then presumably pass on that knowledge to the younger people, and you have that sort of conveyor belt of IP going through. Well, that disappeared, and people just, it was just depressed. And all of the outlook was that nuclear was going to stop, just virtually by 2030 to 2040, it was going to be non-existent. Behind this profile, though, there were sort of about six reactors in 65. And by 2000, there were nearly 430 reactors. So it was a huge, huge sort of build. So although there was an exploration downturn, the contractual part of the building of the fleet continued on. And by the end of the that century, there was 20%, 19% of electricity was provided by nuclear. So we moved into this depressed period. I started Paladin, and this is the interesting part of, in a contrarian style, and during that downturn in the sort of in the early 90s, when nobody wanted to know about uranium having come out of the West German group. And that allowed me to pick up projects during that low part there and to benefit then from that exploration boom that happened. And that was the phenomenon of Paladin, that you built up, and we really had a hard time. We were a 2 million market cap, and we got, as most of you may know, got to about a $4.5 billion company, and by 2011 at Fukushima time, we had two operations in Africa and a whole pipeline, and it was just a sensation. And then a Chernobyl type event took a place in Fukushima. But before that, so this second cycle was a civilian inspired global scale, get electricity, oil was too politicized and so on. In the end, coal became the major sort of contributor to electricity for reasons I won't go into here. And then we came into, from this dead, horrible outlook of uranium, China declared that in its growing economy, nuclear would be a key plank of its development. And that was in 2004. And off it went. That's where Paladin, as I say, came through. And in 2011, it just died because of Fukushima. I thought actually after Fukushima, after Chernobyl, that there will be a bit more resilience in the system.
Yeah.
And people said, okay, we can fix it, but it didn't happen. And now 9 years later, we've got there was another abandonment of companies, and as you say, there was about 400. Odd companies before Fukushima. The uranium price was still sitting at $73, and it was looking good. Then today, when we come today now, there's from the 400, there's only about 60, as you mentioned. But the big thing is where expertise was in short supply, even after the Chernobyl consequence, of which a lot of the activities of the exploration boom in the early 2000 was affected by this lack of expertise. As guys from other commodities, and uranium is different. It's as I say, it's a lot like the a trucking industry, which is the normal mining industry, and an airline industry, which is the uranium. There's a lot more, sensitivity. There's a lot more perceptions of fear. There's a lot more emphasis on maintenance, confidence, capability of, the community wanting to know that these guys know what they're doing. And so that sort of expertise, you can't just take it and say, oh, I'm a gold guy. And with that attitude, come into uranium. There's just too many people. The commodity in itself, I believe it's got no issues in terms of safety and all of that, but you've got to deal with how people think it is. And you can educate, but there's that feeling, radioactivity, whatever it's called. So now coming to today, you've got the... Not only China is coming in terms of the demand side, and I haven't got any here to talk about that demand, but they are going hell-bent for leather to get, I believe, to get about 20% nuclear. Now, they're sitting on about 6 to 8% at the moment. And so you can imagine how much forward growth. And this period of China growing from about three reactors in 2003 to about 50 today. It's an incredible achievement in this short time, but really it's a period that we'll regard in history as a blueprint period, a period at which China developed its industries, got its universities going, educated the people, the big sort of industrial aspect to build these reactors. That was what happened, and now they come into 2020 and they can look at an expansion period with reactors they know they can build, with whole systems in place which will really herald the beginning of the real future of nuclear in China. So because of this exploration downturn and because nobody's been investing, I thought I had one with the uranium price, which would have shown this. But the uranium price since 1973 has been, in 2011, has been from $73 and sitting on about $20 to $30. No ability for sustainable production.
John, sorry to interrupt you, but 73 pre-Fukushima. So the depressed price is purely around that sort of that fear and people moving away from uranium and saying not interested in the sector. I mean, what's driven the price down to be, I guess, stuck in that 20 to 30 range? And it does it make it unviable for a number of companies to go out there and make viable businesses from the uranium sector?
So in that first cycle you see there was about 2 billion pounds produced, mm-hmm. Of the 8 billion that were produced up to 2020. And when the oil shock happened, there was the hope of building 1,000 reactors by the end of the century. And the exploration boom and the mining that happened were in anticipation of that expectation. So what happened was that when Chernobyl happened, the only reactors that were built after that were the ones that were contracted, and no new reactors were built until 2005 when China came in. But in this period, about 4 billion pounds of uranium were produced. And this created a oversupply of uranium. So the uranium price started going down and down. And when there was the growth that came in from 2005, at 2005, by the way, when China came in, there was another price surge, and the uranium went from $16 to $130, and it sort of came down and relaxed a bit at Fukushima to about $73. But what happened was is that with Japan then stopping its 50 reactors, well, stopping them, repairing them, and then on gradual phase, and they'll probably start up half those reactors, there's been this inventory that's behind the supply side, which has kept the prices low. Now, the whole thing is that primary supply supplies 30% or 70% of uranium, and the other one comes from what they call secondaries. Those secondaries are gradually diminishing, and all results are that the crossover for shortage will be about 2023 to 2024. And that's not far away, and really there should be developers today developing for that anticipation of that shortage, which will happen in that post-2024 period. But because the prices are low, nobody can finance new projects. So you've got this paradox now where the utilities are complacent they think, oh, you know, there's plenty around. Even the major companies like Cameco and Kazatomprom, they're also predicting that there will be, you know, dire consequence if there's not a progressive sort of development. The development anyway of uranium mines takes longer than a normal one. You know, you've got all sorts of regulatory problems to overcome, and there are not enough teams to actually build uranium mines. I would say the only coherent team in the junior brigade that came out was the Paladin group, and that's the group that's with me now. And honestly, when you look at the 20-year history, there have only been three juniors that have gone from junior to uranium suppliers. Mm. In 1955, there was a company called Denison, which became a phenomenon at that time, and now is just a shell of its former self. In the second uranium boom, the only junior that came in was a company called Queensland Mines, and up in Arnhem Land, which people might recall, at Narbarlek. And in the boom of 2005, it was Paladin. So, and the backdrop of all the other production are the major companies, the quasi-government organisation. So you can see there is huge opportunities for juniors, but not every junior is going to make it. Mm. And based on that history, because the expertise that's sort of disappearing exacerbates that issue. So coming to today, there is about four, you know, there's quite a bit of deposits. There's no problem about that. And some of those juniors are over-exaggerating the amount that they will produce. And with us, with that oversupply there, the utilities aren't feeling threatened at the moment.
Right.
And how the utilities work is that they work on long-term contracts, so that for such an expensive capital outlay, they need, you know, 3 to 5, 7 years out of product that they're assured that they're going to get, because uranium is such a small part of the cost structure of electricity out of nuclear, but it's such an important part. But that part means that those long-term contracts are normally negotiated 2 years before the need for that product. And the price that you negotiate for that long-term contract is the price that it resets the price today. So $30 a pound, most production today is not viable, unless you're a byproduct producer or at Kazakhstan where they've got lower production. But Cameco, for instance, are selling on long-term contracts. So even the process, $20, $25 or $30, they're selling at $40. A year ago or 2 years ago, they were selling at $44. But gradually they're coming down as they can't replenish these contracts. And here now we've got the issue. The utilities don't want to give a higher price because they don't want to be a price setter. And yet finally somebody has to break ranks. And as they do, and they come into the sort of shortfall area, there'll be a huge competition for that production which is already there, which is diminishing as all mines are finite. And they have to then make contracts with juniors and who are the reliable juniors. And you will get, I believe, an exacerbation of that shortage, because it'll take longer for these projects to come online. And here we've got this opportunity of a great, you know, sort of price increase. I think it has to be above 50, 55. I think personally, it's $65 to 70 And
wow, that's over double what it is now.
Yes. So that's where we're at. And as I say, I sort of predict this boom that's coming through. It's a 2020. I should move that a bit out a bit. But in 25, there needs to be new mines there, and those new mines will not even be considered by the various boards or even who's going to finance them, unless there's profit in it, and they have to be, you know, $50-$55. And those early companies that will come into mining early are not going to benefit the share. Like, you know, they're eager to come in, but the prices will increase later more. So with those long-term contracts, you lock yourself a little bit out of the upside. So you've got to be careful how much you lock out, because your shareholders need to benefit from the upside. That's, you don't want to sort of lock yourself out in time. So there's complexities how you manage to get into production and move on and participate into a you know.
It's a timing thing, John. It sounds like it's a timing thing, but I want to go back to something that you said earlier, which was about the fear and the sensitivity around the uranium sector as a whole. Is that continuing, and how can you see that changing, that sort of that sentiment of the sensitivity and the fear factor post Fukushima? Because, you know, it was dramatic, but I have heard that, you know, Fukushima was an older style plant, and the technology for these new plants these days mean that they are in fact safer than a lot of other ways that utilities can utilize power. Would that be correct?
So this is the irony of everything. I'll come back to a bit of history, because it's happening again today. When nuclear started from virtually no reactors to 450 by the turn of the last century, and nuclear was growing in an environment of this Cold War that was behind, and all the fear of nuclear and all of that sort of business, and it was competing against coal, for which people saw no risk. So coal was moving, and nuclear was being driven harder and harder in those formative years of that sort of 25 years, and it was just safety control, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, there were levies for uranium, the electricity price coming out of uranium, and those levies were there to build up revenue for waste disposal. So it was even looking after its own, you know, waste, if you like. So, and in fact, it proved wrong, because the risk that coal was putting into the system was far greater than a technically engineered ability to control your issues with nuclear, of which at the moment there's no science to control emissions out of fossil. Coming today. So today the equation is different. Today the equation is renewables, fossil fuels, the whole climate change question, which, you know, everybody's got a position. It's reaching, you know, in parts, religious proportions. You can't argue against it. You can't argue for it. It's there that it's accepted, and they will be the parameters that will guide energy production of a planet that is extraordinarily energy poor still. And the renewables of solar and wind will be an integral part of the future. There's no doubt about that. But it's been over promoted in the sense that something that delivers power for 7 hours out of 24. And what do you do with the rest of the time? What do you do with the sort of 18 or 16 hours of which there's, you know, there's no wind or no this, and you combine your soul and your wind, and they sort of somehow may offset a little bit. But basically, when you look at the enormous amount of power that's needed and the problems that are facing, Australia's a, you know, a case where it's the only developed country that hasn't got a component of nuclear. So Europe has got 20% nuclear. The US has got 20% nuclear. Now, that's a very, very good buffer there that can offset against all your other emissions. You can put renewables against that, but Australia is working from a third world country of, or when you look at the profile of fossil fuel and a bit of hydro and renewables. So it hasn't got.
Have we not got any uranium use at all in Australia? Sorry, just
only a research reactor in Sydney at Lucas Heights, which is there for, you know, isotopes, medicine, and all of those sort of things, which is, you know, essential. But we've locked ourselves out of the future for me. When you look at Canada, you know, you can say, okay, Canada and Australia are about the same population, a bit more Canada, but it's got 12, 13 reactors. It's got an industry. It's got universities and education and skill sets that reflect that high-powered technology, and you've got a type of, you know, you're upgrading your human resources of the country mainly because of the industry that it is. And whereas, I'll be quite blunt, on nuclear and solar, basically you've got installers, and that's what it is. You know, there's no high level, high technical sort of universities that educate in the engineering, chemical, physics, all of these things that are trying to, you know, we don't build anything here. So they're two different levels. So Canada is now building what they call these small, is a prototype of an SMR, these small nuclear reactors, which modular reactors, which fit in as smaller units that are deployable in other areas where the big reactors can't be. So what it does, it doesn't replace these big reactors, which are there and they need it in areas of population, etc. But the nuclear through these SMRs is going to be deployed in other geographies. Outback, isolated Russia, outback in China. So we end up a very, very exciting era. So what happens is now, if you can't have, people are saying, oh, electric cars. Well, electric cars, it's quite obvious now hydrogen is going to be an integral part of transportable, you know, portable power. Trains, buses, trucks, and it's not going to be the lithium battery. And it's not against the lithium battery. The lithium battery serves a purpose right from a little iPhone to a car. But beyond that, it starts to have limitations. So how do you produce hydrogen? You produce hydrogen with high-level heat and electrolysis, and nuclear reactors are born for that. So it's no use making nuclear, and you cannot get enough renewables to have that much spare that you are also going to make hydrogen. It can barely sort of work to you know, store with 1 hour of, you know, of sort of holding in storage while fossil fuels in Australia are fired up to come in terms of this dispatchable power.
So John, just speaking of that, there's a lot of people that, because from my understanding, and I'm not an expert, you're the expert, from my understanding, nuclear energy is one of the cleanest energies that we can have. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And that's by, there are article after article, it's got the the footprint of nuclear is way below everything, even solar. I mean, solar and wind.
And okay, so it's the cleanest. It's one of the cleanest energies. Australia has quite a lot of the supply globally. Is that correct as well? But yet we are not utilizing that. And I'll come back again. You said sensitivity and fear. Is it something that we can continue to educate people and let them know that, you know, you are talking about climate change, one of the cleanest energy. Why do you think the message is not getting out there that this is a very clean fuel source which can lead to a cleaner planet, yet people still have this fear, uncertainty and sensitivity?
Firstly, whether Australia goes nuclear or not is not going to affect the upside of nuclear or the upside of uranium. So essentially, nuclear is there for Australia to benefit if it wants. It's had a history through various policies. I mean, you can't have nuclear. The policies prohibit nuclear in Australia. And there are now moves from Canberra to start the debate again, to start looking at the opportunity for nuclear to be considered as part of the strategic fuel mixes you need to have a zero emission. There's no these people that say 100% with zero emission with nuclear with renewables. It's not possible. No matter what you do, you just there is no, and especially as you realise that it's not just the production of electricity and the cost of electricity production that you've got to look at. It's just that electricity is invading more and more space that was traditionally the place of petrol, of coal, it is an amazing sort of energy source, electricity. It's what electricity was used 40 years ago to what it was used 20 years ago to what it was used is used now are completely different things. Everything is done through the medium of electricity, and even in terms of technologies that will be to counter global warming will require an enormous amount of electricity in things that will whir and buzz and do and all sorts of things to keep things going. So Australia now is not in the psychological space unfortunately. And now these small nuclear reactors, which are really, somebody explained to me, it's like the airline industry. There's only four or five places that build airlines. It's not as if you want an aeroplane, you build your aeroplane in your own city. These are built in highly sort of controlled environments. And these small nuclear reactors are going to be built in such factories. So they'll be actually dispatched as modules out into the site. They'll be made to the very high quality and design. There's not going to be dependent on geography. There's only going to be civils out there. So the whole issue of building them in terms of their safety, a lot of them will be passive safety in them. So this gives another measure now of a technology that it does give the chance for Australia to say, oh, we may be able to use this. The first modular reactors will come in 2025. Already, Russia is using modular reactors, which is coming out of their military and out of their ships and all of that. And they've got barges that then have put electricity out. Now, these ships have been 30 years, 40 years. They've been working without that much problem. So that may change. And I feel sorry for Australia that it doesn't go into this because it doesn't embrace the future in terms of having in-house expertise, in-house professionals, engineers that are of a completely different type. And we're not just installers on rooftops or, you know, hanging off wind things.
There's turbines, those great big turbines all across our landscape.
And they're all coming from elsewhere.
So
everything goes for that. And we cannot, somebody was saying, even last night, there was a very good talk, and it was the a national energy organization saying that if we're tracking where we're going now, we're 4 to 6% increase in degrees by 2050, and we're aiming at 1.5 to 2. And there is no, you said, where it's doomed to failure unless nuclear can brother renewables, and it makes it truly zero emission. And they were saying in their models, even by 2050, there will be 30% coal still going, because there's just so much need, for that to occur. So we have
so 30% coal, even that far out.
Yes. And that's how much electricity is needed, and that's how difficult it is to change. I mean, you only have to look at the change from coal. From wind to coal in ships, how long that took, and then from coal to diesel turbines, and how long that took, and this is the, you know, cars going from petrol to electric. This is going to be a 40-year phenomenon. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't just some analyst out at Sydney works it out and thinks, by 2025, we'll have 20 million cars around. It's not happening. That's why there's this lithium sort of problem that everybody oversupplied it, a little bit like what the when a nuclear, where it was oversupplied in that second nuclear cycle.
Yep.
And now, but there's not enough electric cars being made, and so there's a oversupply, so the lithium price has crashed. Uranium has passed that. And uranium has not had its sort of coming of age, if you like, and now it has. That there is more and more people saying that nuclear is part of that future. That if people believe in global warming, and they should, and emissions and environmental and all those sensitivities that are now around, well, like it or hate it or love it, it'll have to be there, because it delivers exactly what's needed for the survival of the planet, combined with renewable. And that's the exquisite equation that it is. And some people don't want to face that reality.
And I think also, John, we must mention the fact that nuclear has come a long way from the early days. I mean, you look back, Chernobyl, 1986, from a technological point of view, from a safety point of view, from a environmental point of view, nuclear has completely moved so much further forward. And that sort of fear and sensitivity that people have, they really actually need to dig a little deep and understand that, as you said, these small nuclear reactors that are going out. I mean, if you go to France these days, I think it's over 90% of France's electricity supply is nuclear, I believe. And they have a lot of the
78,
yes. 78.
And they now are talking about, they were saying, the nuclear side was going to go down a bit, but now there's a revival, because they also believe in the hydrogen technology for heavy duty haulage, and that they will need a lot of these reactors to supply clean hydrogen. And there's nowhere in Australia today where you can get clean hydrogen. There's just not enough renewable capacity. It can, you know, yes, at daytime the rooftops are overload, you know, overloading grids, but you know, when you look at what power the nation needs, a lot of it is sort of hidden out there outside your own electricity and lights and everything. You know, when you look at the bitumen in your street, the amount of energy that needs in an industrial sense, that car you've got out there, all of those things, everything you see that's built is electricity. Hidden beyond your electric lights and your fridge and your dishwasher. And and these are the whole issues of how to reorganize energy. You know, it's an exciting period. I mean, I think it's just.
I agree, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're running out of time. And one of the things I must ask you about is you had a resounding success with your tenure at Paladin. And I want to talk to you about Deep Yellow, ASX code DYL. And I believe you joined them in October 2016, which is actually not that long ago, really, coming up 4 years. Tell us a little bit about Deep Yellow and tell us about your plans from an investment point of view. You know, you understand this sector, bit of a contrarian play, if I may say so, because of its lack of, I guess, interest at the moment. But that's the time where opportunities are made. So let's talk Deep Yellow.
Okay, so the first thing is that when I left Paladin, I thought, oh well, look, I move on to something else. And after about 12 months or 6 months, actually, it really hit me that that there was another boom coming up of a different type to the one that I started Paladin with. In contrarian fashion, Paladin was started on the hope that new reactors would be built, and that nobody believed that would be, and that meant that, you know, the properties I got, I could work under the radar. In Deep Yellow, the reason that I've come in is that it's supply that's the question, no question about it. The growth of nuclear is assured. China, Middle East, Russia, India, as the cornerstones of growth in Southeast Asia. And around that, there's a whole periphery of other nations that will build. When nuclear started in the 70s, it was only four countries that drove it, the US, Japan, and France, and the sort of the UK and Germany. And then 32 countries, you know, another 28 countries came, followed through. So and not only the supply, but I thought there's a lack of expertise, that my teams were the only ones that built modern uranium mines in the last 30 years up to, you know, when we started them in 2007. So I thought a great opportunity, and uranium price was low. It's depressed, which I actually wanted, and it would allow me to do things. And the thing is, raising money in that environment, it's easy to say, oh, you know, when property prices are depressed, you know they're going to go up. But you go to the bank and they say, no, I'm not going to lend you any money because the property prices are depressed. So money, it's not the idea. It's also having access to funds. Mm. So because of my history in Paladin, I got people, I said, look, this is what I want to do. It's a different way, but still the same. We're going to build, et cetera, et cetera. So I raised funds, and I knew Deep Yellow very well, and looked at many companies. I thought Deep Yellow was the one. And Namibia is a great jurisdiction for uranium. There's been two modern mines being built. The first one being the one I built in Langer Heinrich, and now with the Chinese, another one. And I thought that the exploration that was done there was not done properly to identify the true potential. And so it was going to be a dual strategy of enhancing the project, the uranium, you know, the projects in Namibia, and also acquiring projects to build a pipeline to give future optionality to and the third asset was the team, which I regard unique, and everybody talks about their management. This is one, though, that has built uranium mines. Mm. No others have. And it's not just one guy that's part of it. You've got to have it in a coherent techno-corporate environment that's surrounded with all of the social aspects and the confidence of the utilities, etc. So, and blow me down. We have had fabulous success in Namibia.
Tell us about that success in Namibia with Deep Yellow.
Basically, we started off that there was these deposits there that were small, and nothing much. Everybody was sort of concentrating on them, and of these Langer-Heinrich type deposits, which are in old river system, paleo channels. And even when I was in Paladin, I could see that there was potential there. So when we started, we revisited that whole thing, redefined its the geology of it, isolated these large river systems, ancient river systems, and we've tripled the resource base. Wow. Of that for basically, 7 million dollars, which is 11 cents a pound discovery. That has moved into a pre-feasibility study. We've announced some results. It's really looking great. It'll be another sort of Langer-Heinrich type operation, and we know we're going to make it even a bit more efficient than that project. And we're hoping to finish this in December, and then move on to a definitive study. And we think it's timed right in terms of the price. We're moving there, and when we sort of end up with a definitive study with the team that we are, we believe we'll get a lot of support from utilities, because they know that there'll be very little risk in us delivering product, which is the real key to it. People that haven't delivered uranium, uranium is not like gold. I mean, if it's gold in the ground, there are hundreds of teams, great companies that are delivering, getting it. So ounces in the ground to, ingots in the mint is a real equation that that you can turn. But pounds in the ground in uranium to pounds in the drum are a completely different thing.
It's more complex, is that right?
It's more complex, that's what I mean. And there's much more filters to get you to where you're going. And those sort of things are that utilities, you can't hedge. A utility can't get a contract with you, with a potential producer that has never produced, and say, "Oh, look, I'll give you $200 million and I'll support that," and then and then the risk is that if they don't get that product in 3 years' time, they have a shortage. There's nowhere else they can go, especially at a time when uranium price is going to be higher, and everybody acknowledges that. So you can't, and really, the producers don't know what they're letting themselves into, because a long-term contract puts a legal obligation on you to deliver.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So there's a real sort of difficult equation. So we're very excited by what's happening in Namibia, and we've also got a joint venture with the Japanese, which we're going to make some great announcements shortly. That's coming up nicely as well. So it's a tremendous jurisdiction for a cornerstone of a production future, and then we've just got to get some runs on the board for some acquisitions that we're looking at the moment.
Well, you heard it here first, but John, you said it very well just before. It is about management, and you've got the team around you. It's a team that's delivered it before. It's not like gold. These are complex and interesting ways that they've got to deliver the product, as you said, from pounds in the ground to pounds in the drum. It's a very different way than digging up gold out of the ground. Any final comments, John, before we finish up?
I've enjoyed talking here. I genuinely believe that people should invest in uranium companies. I think that when uranium prices go up, all companies will go with the tide. And there will be, the big thing is, and this is where I'm telling guys, that yes, we're down to sort of 60 companies, of which there are only 50 listed companies. And those 50 will become 150 to 200, because as price goes up, there'll be a swarm of people coming through. So getting positions in whichever one is your desire is, I think it's now, it is time. My thing is I think uranium is still got about, 12 months to go before it really starts turning. Right. Good sound investment to get a bit of your investment into some good quality uranium project companies.
Well, as you said before, John, and I say it to you guys all the time, don't I? I say, you've got to look at the management. You've got to look at, they've done it before. John's bought the team from Paladin to get Deep Yellow up and running. Got a DFS coming up. Lots of news flow coming ahead of you. John Borshoff, CEO and Managing Director of Deep Yellow. Thanks for chatting to us today.
And all pleasure, Craig. Bye now.